The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
I provoke strong opinions.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS, and I'm joined by my co-host, SBS Channel Manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Fee. How much of a US political junkie are you?
Oh, good Lord. Well, I reach on my phone as soon as I wake up to see what's happened overnight. So, you know, put that on the scale. Yeah.
To find out what new disaster has happened.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm riveted. Yeah, what about you?
You know, I am always very invested in these presidential races, which brings us to today's show. Because this week on The Playlist, we step into a world of political hopes and disappointments in both the acclaimed documentary series Hillary and a new season of Christine Baranski's The Good Fight. And we catch up on what you have been watching.
Great. Yes. Well, we are in under 50 days to the US presidential election now. So come what may, you know.
Yes. Well, it has prompted us at SBS to do, you know, what we do every 4 years and take a long look at the US presidency, both present and past. And we've had documentaries on George W. Bush. We've got an upcoming one on Richard Nixon and the Watergate saga. But we also have launching on SBS and SBS On Demand a new documentary series over 4 hours, Hillary.
I provoke strong opinions.
Are we ready?
There's so much to talk about.
Okay. I didn't grow up thinking about going into politics, but much to my surprise, was elected president of the Republicans. I got into law school. I thought I'm going to try to make a difference in people's lives.
I took a class and I saw Hillary sitting there.
And he was watching me.
She closed her law book.
I said, if you're going to keep looking at me and I'm going to keep looking back, we ought to know each other's names. I'm Hillary Rodham. Who are you?
She was different than anybody I ever met. I said, I really want to marry you, but you shouldn't marry me.
There is a set of expectations about a first lady. I violated them from the very beginning.
She brought to the forefront women's roles in society.
This is radical feminism.
Me deciding to ask Hillary to become Secretary of State surprised people.
Hillary's polarizing.
Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights.
People would run up clutching copies of that speech, reciting that line from it.
And so obviously this one is about a presidential hopeful, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I have to say it's a documentary which does make you wonder how the world could have been different if the outcome had changed those, you know, 4 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, if that hasn't crossed your mind in these last 4 years and it took this documentary to make you think that, but no, it really does. It's... You know, nothing's off the table, really. It's a one-on-one with Madam Secretary, you know, would-be Madam President. But obviously she's not running for office now, so she's very candid, more candid than she ever would have been if she was still in public life in the way that she has been throughout her entire life. And it's the definitive story, as told by her, but also as told by her associates and her husband too.
Yeah, so this was directed by Nanette Burstein, who I think one of the first things she made was the incredible documentary along with Brett Morgan, The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yeah, I love that documentary.
About Robert Evans, a must-watch for any film lover and any doco lover. Hmm. And she also made The Price of Gold for the ESPN 30 for 30 season about Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding. It was the inspiration for the movie I, Tonya, and we have had that on SBS in the past. Also another documentary, sort of quite a nice telling of sort of high school life, American teen. Mm. But I get the sense watching this series that originally this was intended to be the story of how Hillary won the election, and she was shooting backstage a lot of behind the scenes footage throughout the whole campaign, which is sort of interwoven through the four parts.
Not at all, though. No, I mean, we've got Nanette Burstein coming up very shortly, but no, it's quite the opposite. She inherited all of that footage.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, no, she wasn't involved in that. We've got some really inner circle kind of footage, you know, the nights of the debates that we see some debate prep. You see some staffer who has to play the role of Donald Trump and try and intimidate her to prepare her for the what was coming in the debates. So, yeah, I'll let her tell it herself. But, her role was the sitting down and doing the interviews with Hillary and all and her associates.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to listening to your chat with Nanette Burstein. Now that you've teased it so much, it's going to be interesting to hear her take, because someone that we do see in a lot of that behind-the-scenes footage is Huma Abedin, who, of course, documentary lovers and political junkies in general will know was previously married to Anthony Weiner and was the focus of the 2016 documentary Weiner, which looked at Anthony Weiner's attempts to re-enter politics unsuccessfully. And both she and her ex-husband played a fairly pivotal role in Hillary's election campaign because, of course, with minutes to spare before the polls opened, his laptop got pulled into an FBI investigation into his sexting scandals, which then revealed some of Hillary's private emails, which, of course, was a huge election issue the whole way through.
Because, of course, it was, yes. So that all dragged in, and you see all of that. You see, well, Hillary reflects on that, but also you see some of the footage of Huma just like... And that's what this documentary does so well. I mean, you know, Hillary and Bill, of course, are covered in great depth, but just the way that the coincidences that plague her life, the fact she stayed with Bill after, you know, he disclosed that it actually was an affair with Monica Lewinsky, and she was criticised for doing that, for not leaving him ultimately. So, you know, that came back to bite her. And then Huma, of course, in a divorce, she's plagued by her husband as well. It's just what I love broadly in the way that this documentary is put together is that you just see from the early days of Hillary's life, you know, actions she took, decisions she made, whatever, have all echoed throughout her life in weird and coincidental ways. You know, she was on the legal team for the impeachment of Nixon. And then, so, you know, she's an expert on impeachment, and then her husband ends up getting impeached. And then the current occupant of the White House, you know, has his own impeachment moment. But yeah, so that is a weird connection. But there's lots of those throughout, and like too many for me to mention or recall now. But it's just fascinating, this life that she's led, always in the public eye. And you see how aspects of her personality that she was criticized for in the campaign, of, you know, not being natural, etc. You see how she used to be, and then that backfired too. So you can understand kind of how this personality has evolved, and it's fascinating to see her reflect on it too.
And the way that she's reinvented herself over time and been often forced to reinvent herself because of the political expectations that she faced. But I think that a real strength of the series is the way it interweaves that sort of past history with the story of the 2016 campaign. And I think it does that really effectively. And you mentioned, of course, you know, plagued by the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and her husband, you know, Bill, is interviewed as part of this and opens up in a way that I haven't seen him open up in interviews before.
Yeah.
But it did make me question, I mean, you asked that very question about, you know, she was kind of criticized for staying with him. But why do you think, you know, after having watched 4 hours of her, you know, sort of speaking about her life, why do you think they are still together?
Yeah. Look, I think she reflects on it. Like, she genuinely loves him. And like it's because you see also early on the compromises she made also to give up a promising legal career to move to Arkansas to support his political career. And, you know, then stymied her own ambitions, well, put them on ice for a few decades.
And of all the Hillary content out there, there's also the novel Rodham that's out about her making the decision not to marry Bill and how that may have changed her life in a different way.
Yeah. No, it's just so fascinating. And there's these conflicts and compromises and things. And who am I to say why they're still together? But, that scene, it's in episode 3 where Bill is asked by Nanette about all of it and, specifically about not the torture details of the affair, but, the having to disclose to Hillary and the world, but, the moment of having to tell Hillary, actually, yes, I did it. And his body language is incredible in that. And so, I wanted to know what's it like to shoot that, to ask Bill Clinton the definitive questions about Monica. So, it's a lot.
I agree. I think there is a deep love and bond between the two of them, which in some ways defies a bit of belief that it could have withstood everything that he's done and that they've been through. And, God, even now there's these Jeffrey Epstein allegations around Bill. But we'll save that for another time. Yeah. I think you've done enough teasing now. I think that we really should get to the chat. I will say that for anyone who feels like they already know everything that they want to know about Hillary Rodham Clinton, I really would say give this a go and sit down there with the first episode, and I think that you'll find yourself pulled in and sort of new elements of the story will be revealed. That's what I'd leave you with. All right, you had a chance to sit down with the director virtually, Nanette Burstein, and let's have a listen.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Hello, yes, all good.
Sorry, I had to restart. It was sometimes does that.
That's okay. Yeah, I know. That's the joys of Zoom, hey? Really appreciate it. It's such a treat to talk to you. Because, I love the documentary, Full Disclosure. No secret, Hillary Clinton has, a reputation for being guarded, infamously so, to the extent, she jokes about it on the campaign trail.
Yes.
Why do you think she agreed to do this deep dive in the first place?
Well, it's funny because initially it was presented to her before I was involved as, okay, we have all this footage that the campaign shot of the election of you behind the scenes, and the initial idea was this would be a campaign film or a film about the campaign. Obviously, the election's over. But then once I got involved and I wanted to open it up into this much broader story in her whole life, she, I think, was very open to it for a couple of reasons. One was I was wanting to frame it in the context of the arc of the women's movement and our history of partisan politics. And so she could see that there was that her life served a bigger purpose that would be communicated to an audience and that there would be a lot learned other than just some sort of vanity piece about her life or on flip side, some very dark version of her life. I think it was also about legacy. She's not going to run for office anymore. She is not worried about what she has to say in the same way. I mean, her entire adult life, she had to worry because, from the time she was in her early 30s, she was the First Lady of Arkansas.
Yeah.
And it just didn't end her political career up until a couple of years ago. So I think she felt like the timing was right to do this kind of piece and have some kind of legacy of who she was and what she accomplished. And even though it was going to be, she wasn't have creative control, but I think in the end she trusted me. I wasn't like a hardcore conservative or anything.
Yeah. You went after a gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was over the course of a week you spent in her house. Was it full 7 days, shooting every day?
It was actually broken up because we thought we would get it all done in a few days. So we had 3 days scheduled. And by the third day, we're like, okay, we're only halfway through the story. And so we rescheduled for a couple months later and did another 3 days. And then the idea was always to save a day for the end, fill in any holes. So that's how it worked.
Mm. And so when was this, sort of just like in a world timeline of whatever else was going on, when was, let's say, the first 3 days you spent, and when did you go back?
The first 3 days I spent with her was only a few days after our midterm elections here in the United States, where a lot of women were elected, a lot of Democrats were elected. It was a very joyous time for people who were, you know, female Democrats. So we were all in a good mood. And I know she had worked hard behind the scenes to help a lot of candidates fundraise for them in a quiet but effective way. So that was in November of 2018. And then I went back in January of 19. And then the last day, I think, was September of 2019.
And over the course of talking to her, how, you know, was she a little guarded at first, and then you noticed to, you know, were able to chip away at some of that?
Yes, that's exactly right. She was guarded. I mean, most people are when they're being interviewed. Yeah. Like, she was more guarded than her husband was right away, but that's just the difference in personalities. And also, she's not used to doing this kind of interview. I mean, she's been interviewed millions of times in her life, but always with a very specific agenda of, you know, the news of the day, or they are, you know, trying to get a certain kind of soundbite out of her, and that's it. And she knows it, and they know it, and it's this dance. So she's never just been able to speak freely about all the various things she thinks and feels in her life story and anecdotes and that kind of way. So I think it took some getting used to, like, oh, I can just open up and relax. And that did take some time for her, understandably.
Yeah, no doubt. And like, how did you go in? Like, did you have set questions, or you just kind of let her talk as you?
I did have set questions. I had like a book of questions, but I don't look at them while I'm interviewing people. I memorize it all. And then when we're taking a break, I'll just, you know, kind of glance at it and make sure I've forgotten things or... But yes, I definitely have a whole roadmap of what I want to cover, but I also let the conversation go where it needs to. So if she starts to talk about something else and I know that's also something I want to discuss, then I'll just go there and then I'll bring it back to another question. And it's just sort of that's the forum.
Yeah. And I mean, I love the way that in her life, but obviously in her life, but in the film, you demonstrate that experiences from her past are reverberating constantly throughout her life, you know, in really obvious ways, but also in ironic and, you know, many depressing ways. Was that kind of how you went in wanting to frame the film that way? And did you realise there were so many ways that the past echoed? Or was it something that revealed itself more and more as you were talking and going through the archive?
No, it was, I knew I wanted to try that approach from almost the get-go. And part of the reason was to make these connections. Another part of the reason was I had this amazing asset of all of this behind-the-scenes footage of her in the election. And I didn't want to wait till episode 4 to show that. So I thought, okay, I'll interweave. And that's very hard to do, actually, to constantly create these transitions where you can go in and out of past and, you know, two different timelines.
Yeah.
But fortunately, it was also illuminating as well. And, you know, that was one of the trickiest parts of making the series.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. I've got a question on that. Like, you know, it's a treasure trove, but how big a team did you have going through all the archive, like actual archive of her time as, you know, in the public eye, but equally the campaign stuff that they provided you? And like on that, what was the brief to not overload it with clips as well? I mean, it's amazing, but.
So we basically just got handed thousands of hours of footage of her behind the scenes of the campaign. But a lot of it was, you know, another angle on a speech or a rope line. And within that, there were these diamonds in the rough that, you know, are all in the series. But it took a lot of time and effort to find them. So that was a big team of, I think we had 4 assistant editors organizing all the footage, 2 editors watching it all and making selects, and it took 4 months to go through that. And then while that was going on, I was also reading everything about her, and I wrote a whole treatment of how I saw the story unfolding, you know, going through the timeline, past and present. And so we started to collect archive at that point outside of the election. And it was an ongoing process. We just kept getting more and more archive as needed. You know, you'd start to cut a section and you realize, oh, I'm still missing this kind of clip or this kind of clip. So you just keep looking for it and asking for it. And so it was an ongoing process.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the crucial Hillary and Bill interviews, but equally it's an impressive roster of people you've got talking. There's a few notable absences, and I've got my theories about why some people aren't featured, but I'd love to hear it from you, especially on the Republican side. Was that intentional or not for lack of trying?
No, it was not intentional. It was a big effort, and no one would do it. Bill Frist did it, and there was a couple of others who were more middle of the road Republicans, but yeah, it was across the board. People just either said no or said, oh, I don't have time, but they would never have time, you know, just the blow off. And then Newt Gingrich, who was, you know, an adversary of the Clinton in the 90s and plays a role in this story, an important one, he told me on the phone that he would rather stick a needle in his eye than do an interview about Hillary Clinton. So well, at least he was actually the most honest of all of them.
Yeah, so that's a no. yeah, right. Dare I ask, did you try to get Trump at all?
No, I didn't, because I didn't think he would do it.
Yeah, and also, yeah. and, you know, he doesn't figure much at all other than in archive, and there's only a token reference, passing reference, I think, in episode one to him.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing. I didn't want to do this deep dive into relitigating the 16 election too much, so I felt like if I got him, it would just become about that, and I thought that the series could get confusing as far as the content went, so.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's better without him. There's too much of him everywhere. And I'd love to know your take on the journalists you spoke to, the journalists and biographers especially, you know, Peter Baker from New York Times, who are active right now in framing the next election, the upcoming one. You know, what's your take on the way they talk about how they covered Hillary and the actions? And is there much self-awareness of their role in framing public perception?
No. I mean, they're very smart, so I'm sure there is, but I don't think that they feel that it's their fault that she lost, if that's what you're asking. And other people might feel that way. You know, people that are real Hillary supporters find that they're hypocritical. I don't know if I agree with that. It's a tough one. The New York Times, which is, it's trying to be a middle of the road newspaper, but it's not. And I think it's just decided that it doesn't care about going after Trump all the time, every day, because it's so outrageous. But during the 16 election, they were trying to do this balanced reporting, which meant that if they did a story about how, you know, some obscene thing that Trump said, they felt that they had to equally do a negative story about Hillary, but it wasn't the same. And so there was so much focus on her emails all the time, which is to me a non-story, or her Wall Street speeches, or just anything that you can come up with. But yeah. I'm not sure in hindsight that they feel that was a mistake on their part, that they feel that they had to be fair journalists. So.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That was more what I was thinking, like in terms of how they might apply those learnings to the current campaign and, you know, the fan or the perception of balance.
I think on an unconscious level, they have, just watching the reporting that's happening now in, you know, the Times and the Post, Washington Post, it seems they're not trying to do this equal amount of, you know, negative stories on Trump versus Biden at all in any way. I think people are way over that. we're in a new dimension.
yeah, exactly. Everything, all bets are off in 2020. And of course the Bill Clinton interview, we can't not go past that, but You know, that sequence about Monica Lewinsky and the disclosure to Hillary that actually it's so raw. Talk us about, like, the lead up to shooting that, how you just let him talk. Did his answer surprise you? Yeah, talk us through, like, the you in that room talking to Bill about...
Yeah, I mean, he knew I was going to ask him about that, and that was a discussion that happened beforehand with his communications people, and it needed to, because yeah. I didn't want to just bring that on him. Yeah. But still, I didn't know how honest he would be and how candid he would be. But once we went there and started discussing it, he really opened up, and he was actually shaking physically and really emotional, teary-eyed. Yes, that surprised me that he was so candid. And I think he wanted to do that for her, to give her something back to say, like, look, I just screwed up and this shouldn't have affected her life the way it did, and it's my fault. And also, you know, my questions were really about him and his family. And it wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing this lurid deep dive into the details of his affair with Monica Lewinsky. I didn't ask any questions about that. We all know what happened, and we didn't need to go there for the purpose of this documentary. It's about his wife. So the other thing that had happened, which I think led to him feeling like he wanted to be honest, was the Me Too movement had been going on for several months prior to this. And he had done an interview, he was promoting a novel, and he was asked if he ever apologized to Monica Lewinsky, which, even though his novel had nothing to do with this, but because we were in the Me Too era, and he was just unprepared for an answer. And he stuttered and got very defensive, and it was a PR disaster. So I think this was also an opportunity in a safer environment, where I'm not just looking for the 1 minute bad soundbite from Bill Clinton, to speak about it and make sure that people know how that he's a real person and he's remorseful and he's got, it's complicated. But yeah, I was surprised at how honest he got.
Yeah, no, that all comes through. And how long kind of did that take? I was trying to look on his watch. You can sort of see, glimpse his watch occasionally. I was trying to see the time.
Yeah. Well, the whole interview took place over a couple of days. Right. And it was broken up. I interviewed him for one day in November and then a second time in January. And that was towards the end of the second day that I asked him about it. So he got to spend some time with us, and you know, he's a very social guy, so he's not hard to get him to open up in general, although I'm sure he would not openly talk about this in a normal situation ever. This is the first and only time he's ever done that.
Yeah
probably last.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable, the same. And, you know, back to Hillary, even when she's reflecting on it, like the body language, you know, we talk about her body language being constantly analysed, but in this instance, just the way, you know, you can tell the impact on her of having to relive it a little bit as well. Yeah. And how did you tread in those scenes with her?
Yeah, she knew that she was going to talk about it. I mean, she had agreed to discuss it also. From the get-go, you know, discussing this project, I brought it up and said, you know, we do have to talk about your marriage. And, but she was not looking forward to it at all, which was abundantly clear to me and her. And so it was very difficult for her. You know, she is a private person. She says so in the series. And I mean, she said so in the interview and I put it in the series. So it was hard for her to discuss that, you know.
Yeah. And in, you know, you incorporate the moments before the official interview, you know, the makeup retouching and the chat moments before the formal start, you know, still rolling the tape. What's your intent in sort of incorporating the camera on, well, the camera's always on, but the on-off kind of moments with her?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, you know, there's a nice sort of very candid rapport. I mean, she's very candid in the interview, but there's more of a pull back the curtain kind of feeling to it. And because she's perceived as so guarded, it's nice to see that part of her. The other thing is that, you know, she's constantly being judged for what she looks like, and you know, you even see in the course of the series why she used to be this sort of bra-burning liberal who never wore makeup and wore Coke bottle glasses and did not care about dressing a certain way, and you know, learned a hard lesson of the consequences of that in public life. So, you know, just the ordeal of having to constantly put on makeup. I mean, if she had her druthers, she would still never wear makeup if she didn't have to. And she doesn't, unless she's in public. She doesn't.
She gives a very good eye roll, I have to say. Like, it's just
a good shimmy.
Yeah. Yeah. And elsewhere, like, you know, that's obviously showing a bit of filmmaking, little nod to the audience, but like elsewhere when you draw attention to the filmmaking process, and even in some of the campaign footage you inherited, you know, when people say put the camera away or whatever, that one with Tim Kaine is incredible, the talking about the just all that foresight of what's inside.
I know, that was so prescient. Yeah, I left in when people are like, and usually it was Huma Abedin saying like, stop rolling now, and I don't blame her at that, you know, because they're like, what are you doing? So I left that in because I felt, you know, I just wanted this, I wanted the authenticity of the experience to shine through, you know, that this is not a slick production and that there is always a level of caution going on. And there's when the camera's on and when the camera's off and when the camera's being told to be turned off, and all that plays into layers of the story. So I thought that was important to show.
Yeah. Totally. And you could end the film in the ashes of the campaign and be a massive bummer, but, you know, you don't. There are real shoots of optimism that you leave it on. How did you know when to end it? How did you know you had an ending?
Well, you know, I had to end because we had to finish it. So, but, you know, even when I was just starting to film these interviews, as I mentioned, it was the midterm elections that happened. And then during the course of cutting it, all of these various women were running for president. Now, none of them won the nomination, but the fact that there were just so many women running and so many women that won in the Senate and Congress, it just shows you the breadth and scope of her story. Because there's a soundbite at the end of the series that I feel totally encapsulated her life, that Cheryl Mills, who was one of her colleagues, who's quite esteemed in herself, you know, talks about her being the tip of the spear and that she paved the way for other women to pursue these kind of endeavors that we've never seen happen before. And that's tough, you know, to be that person that's the pioneer, because you're never going to get everything you want and you're going to have a lot of heartbreak. And there's a lot of sacrifice involved in that, but that really does encapsulate her life. And change is incremental. Like, you know, the first person who tries to do something often doesn't succeed, but it makes it so much easier for the next person to do it. So,
yeah, Cheryl is so funny.
That was the end of the story. And of course, you know, giving her the last word of, you know, she has no regrets and she doesn't, you know, she's had such a rich life and continues to, there's another chapter there.
So. Yeah, totally. And picking up on the whole echoing of the past as well. I mean, you know, you do get the sense that like Hillary will echo through the next generations of female leaders, you know, we can only hope.
Yeah.
Big broad question. Well, what surprised you most in the time you spent with her? What did you, coming out of it rather than when you were going in?
You know, I'd always heard that she was very warm and personable in one-on-one or in, you know, smaller settings. And that was true from the first time I met her, and it was true all the way through. I was surprised at how she gave me the reins and was not controlling over the creative part of the process, that she, you know, I had final cut and that there were no questions off limits. She didn't ask for the questions beforehand, that she took a leap of faith. And everything I've heard about the Clintons and their reputation is how controlling they are. And I had the opposite experience. So That, you know, all of that surprised me.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, she's copped her fair share of criticism. That's the biggest understatement ever. But, you know, what do you, I don't know, yeah. What of her flaws do you think are fairly critiqued? Like, did you see some things come across that you thought, that's where that comes from?
Yes. I mean, I do think that, and I try to call this out in the series, is, you know, she definitely has a self-righteous quality. She can have bad optics as a result of that. You know, she's made some decisions that, okay, maybe she, in her mind, she's like, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should anyone care? But the problem is you have to just think about how things appear, you know, and you can't live your life according to that. But it's, you know, there's some obvious ones that she's done that were, I think, in hindsight, she shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Like, you know, doing speeches for Wall Street in the 2016 campaign was not a good timing given where the country was in our relationship to Wall Street. I do think she can be guarded and it's harder for her to let down her guard. I understand why she's that way, but sometimes it doesn't do her any favors. And you know, she can be so warm and she's great in public. Like if she's interacting with people, she's fantastic. Sometimes if she just has to speak to a camera, she can get a bit stiff and it's harder for her. So, you know, she's not perfect in any way, but she's pretty damn cool. I really admire her.
And you know, the biggest irony of course is that if this film had come out then maybe it had swayed people, but also it wouldn't have been this film, would it?
Yeah. And then also people would have thought it was a campaign ploy and wouldn't have regarded it the same way. So I don't know. Yes, that's what everyone says. If only I had seen this before the election. You're like, yeah, but you might not have trusted it then. So
yeah,
it would have been the same piece of work, but you might have seen it through a deafened lens.
Yeah, and she wouldn't have given the same answers, probably.
She wouldn't have at all. Oh, my God, it would have been impossible. She would have never even agreed to it, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. So coulda, woulda, shoulda, but yeah. Yeah. Oh, how did you only make it 4 episodes, by the way? There's just so much in there. Each one could have been a feature ep.
Yeah. Well, at one point it was 5 and it got tightened down. I don't know. It's also like what people's appetite, like how many hours of Hillary Clinton will they watch? And
yeah. Yeah, I mean,
I'm just worried about 4, frankly. I mean, not that it's not absolutely fascinating and I'm very proud of it, but it's just it can get intimidating for people before they start watching it. Like if something has too many episodes, they're like, ugh, it seems too overwhelming, you know, and it turns people off and then they never tune in. So,
yeah, not fair. Well, you left me wanting more, but, well, yeah, look, I loved it. Thank you. And also, you know, I'm a big fan of Kid Stays in the Picture as well from back in the day.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And, I love the way you start that with, you know, about the version of the truth and, you know,
yeah. Just,
yeah. So is that kind of a principle you apply? Like this is Hillary's and Bill's take on their lives.
Oh. It is. Although that, you know, the Robert Evans film was very unique. It was really like a play on documentary and it's like just being very forthright. Like this is one man's version of his story and it's not really true. But it is there's a universal truth to it, but like don't fact check anything. You know? Because it's you're just gonna go on a ride. And it's gonna capture the essence of who he is and it's okay that it's larger than life. And so that, you know, I don't think none of my other projects have been that one-sided but you know that was just it worked for that story because Robert Evans was a Hollywood character and his whole life was, you know, spinning yarns and creating an image and having that image tarred, which ruined his life. So it fit with who he was.
Yeah, totally. And also on SBS, the broadcaster who has this, we've had before and are reacquiring the Tonya Harding, The Price of Gold doc that's coming back on air. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, no, it does really well every time it screens, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, and I'd love to know what other stories Have you got much on your plate if and when the world returns to normal? But
Yeah, I have a few things. I can't really talk about them yet because they're not one of them I'm selling. I haven't pitched yet. I'm in the process. And a couple of them I've pitched, and at some point we'll go forward. So,
yep.
But you know, they're all biographies on fascinating people, or fascinating to me. I think fascinating for everyone, I hope. But that's kind of my cup of tea.
Excellent. And one thing we'd love to ask, I guess, what they've been watching. What have you been watching lately that loving or hating?
You know what I've been watching? I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I've been watching it like every night before I go to bed.
Yeah.
And giving me weird dreams. Is I never watched The Sopranos.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so same.
And so I'm sure this is not exciting for your listeners who have listened, but I never watched it. And so I've been going back and watching all the seasons, which has been both traumatizing and joyous.
I confess, I haven't done it either. So, I've got.
Oh, it's so good. And I was just too busy at the time. I didn't get into it. And now with the pandemic and having extra time and you can stream at your leisure, I've just gone back and watched it. And it's fascinating.
Where are you up to?
I'm just started season 4.
Okay.
So I think there's 7 seasons. So that's what I'm watching.
Oh, good answer. Thank you. Yeah. No, it's not just the latest stuff. I love to just see what's on people's watch list, especially, as you say, a bit more time to stream at the moment. And where in the world are you and how's everything going there?
So I'm in the Catskill Mountains, which is a couple hours outside of New York City. I normally live right around New York City, but it's nicer to be in the woods. And I've always had this place in the mountains. So now I'm here full time. So it's been great. I don't know what any of it's going to be like in winter for us, but just have to see.
Well, look, thank you so much. It's been such a treat to talk to you. And stay safe. All the best.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Annette. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
So that was Nanette Burstein, and that was such a thrill.
And I think, Fee, you should share with listeners to the podcast what you were wearing, especially for that interview.
It's true. Yeah, we've switched from what have you been watching to what we're wearing in the interview. just for this one, I do have a Hillary T-shirt purchased through the Samantha Bee Full Frontal show. Remember the Nasty Woman? It's a Nasty Woman T-shirt based on the the attempt to get her from the idiot in the White House in one of their debates. So, yes, I was wearing my Nasty Woman T-shirt for the occasion.
And if you want to know more about the nasty woman in question, Hillary is launching on SBS Wednesdays 8:30, and every single episode will be dropping on SBS On Demand.
So while we're on a political theme, and specifically Hillary Clinton theme, we're now talking The Good Fight, which is back and which opens for its 4th season with a bit of a what-if episode that kind of reimagines the world if... Certainly, I hope it happened and Hillary Clinton had won the election. What's all that about, Ben?
Yeah, well, we pick up this season with Diane Lockhart having been swatted along with her husband, Kurt, for her role in the resistance against Trump. And with Reddick, Bozeman and Lockhart having been taken over by multinational corporate overlords STR Lorry. Julius Kane has taken a seat at the federal bench only to find himself the subject of a mysterious memo 618, which seems to have the power to subvert the rule of law, something which Diane attempts to uncover, leading to an investigation into a certain Jeffrey Epstein. Let's take a listen.
So, what do you want to do now, Diane?
Get back to work.
What work?
Something's going on. I've had cases disappear when the judge was given Memo 618.
Memo 618.
It seems to allow rich and powerful people to not comply with judicial rulings.
Sir, do you want me to talk?
Yes.
I was asserting privilege.
What privilege?
I can't say. It's privileged.
There was a young man who begged a Zen master to teach him. So the master stuck his head underwater and proclaimed, come back when you want truth as much as air.
You want us to want truth?
white people going to the law.
Oh, good. The angry black woman has made an appearance.
Who would say that was an uncomfortable situation? Who would say that was unacceptable?
I didn't know there was worse than uncomfortable. Can I change my vote?
Rich are not like us.
We all should be subject to the same justice.
If it doesn't work that way, then it's over. We're done.
Your Honor, I just wanted to explain these movements that you see. My goodness. Hate comes in many forms.
So, Fee, as you say, this first episode in this new season takes us in a trajectory that we probably weren't expecting, which is a what-if scenario if Hillary Clinton won the 2016 election. And, of course, you know, most things are better. There's a cure to cancer on the way. The nature's healing in response to some action on climate change. But the fact that Donald Trump wasn't elected also means no women's movement, which means no Me Too movement, which means that Harvey Weinstein's sex crimes remain unexposed.
Yeah. Butterfly effect here. Well, so, yeah, it's complicated.
But the Kings, friends of the show, Robert and Michelle.
I like to call them, yes.
Yeah. And they have always been very savvy about the inner workings of the political system and in particular the Democratic Party. And let's not forget that the very first scene of The Good Wife, of which this is a spin-off, involved an elected official resigning due to corruption and a sex scandal, which was inspired by a number of political scandals, including the one involving Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And in later seasons, we also saw of that show, we saw Peter Florrick, her husband, run for governor. And in the break between Good Wife and this spin-off, they also made a satirical series set on Capitol Hill called Brain Dead. So they're very invested in these political stories, and The Good Fight is no different.
Yeah, and that absolutely comes through. There's a lot of like winking nods to, you know, the worst aspects of liberals, and so it's very knowing in the way they write their drama, with laced with comedy and bit of comedy as well. Yeah, it's very self-aware and amazingly is able to walk that line of referencing the times but also anticipating a little bit what the world is like and, you know, skewering it as well. So it's interesting how this season goes, given it's coming later than what it was originally intended because, remember, there's a pandemic. And also the times have changed since when, you know, the time it was meant to come out. You know, like the ineptitude of the Trump administration has just been amplified in the way it's handled this crisis. So I'm curious, because I know you're a huge fan of the show, how does it handle that? Is it, how does it, when it is so close to the times, but now it's delayed a bit and the, like, is it an escape or is it, what do you make of this season?
Well, I mean, I think that it's certainly a heightened world which it inhabits. And I'm sure, like, you know, many drama makers who have made these shows that are meant to be reflections of the reality we live in to some degree. And if you don't have the pandemic in your storyline, does that work? But I think that it works in that I think we can sort of imagine that this took place as it's intended to this year in the election year, but sort of ahead of the virus hitting. Yeah. And it will be fascinating to see how they sort of deal with that, as it will in other dramas next year. Yeah. But, you know, we see things like the Democratic National Committee enlisting the firm to, which is a predominantly African-American firm, to see what they can do to attract black voters. And that issue of race is very present. And they were on the money in terms of that being a talking point in this election. Yeah. And even then, as I mentioned, we build up to where they're called on to investigate the death of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and under some mysterious circumstances. And that itself, you know, leads to a lot of conjecture around political matters, including Epstein's links to Trump, but also Bill Clinton.
Yeah, yeah. And we should also say, like, we've mentioned the what if scenario in episode one, but that is just contained to episode one, isn't it? So it's not that this whole season is if Hillary's in power and dealing with the world. Maybe that wasn't clear, but yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a little bit of a flight of fancy, not to sort of spoil anything, but I think that this is a show which I think does revel in breaking some of the rules as it's sort of gone from inheriting the structure of a network procedural courtroom drama to becoming, you know, something quite different. And I think to me, this season is a return to form from the last season, which involved a storyline with Michael Sheen's character. And Michael Sheen, you know, I think is sort of very happy to chew the scenery and ham things up, particularly when he's not given a real life character to play. And to me, that was to the show's detriment. And the other thing that they did last season, which stays for the most part out of this season, were these musical interludes where they would use animation to tell the background behind complicated matters of law, which thankfully, in my view, sort of doesn't show its face so much in this new season. I just really, really enjoyed being in the hands of just very, very talented storytellers, both the Kings themselves and the writing team which they've assembled. And to be honest, like even things like the absurdity of office life, which is not something that we're experiencing day to day right now, but things like having dogs in the office and having training for appropriate workplace behavior, all these things rear their head in very amusing ways. And that to me was like a real pleasure of the show.
Yeah, sounds great. And like you say, it builds up to weaving in the Epstein story. I mean, something like that, a scandal like that, that, you know, touches on wealth and power and influence and conspiracy. I mean, that's tailor-made for something like this show, isn't it, that it covers all of that.
Yeah, well, it's all linked to a theme in this season in particular, which is are the wealthy and powerful able to buy their way out of the justice system?
Yeah.
And there have been lots of questions asked about Epstein, which is sort of why the attention goes there, because he did evade justice for so long. Mm-hmm. And then arguably, you know, if you believe in the conspiracy theories, his death was a way for other powerful people, even more powerful than him, to evade justice themselves. Mm-hmm. So that is part of the kind of political ether now, and yeah, and the show's sort of quite interested in sort of how that might play out.
Mm. And there's some good pieces online too about where the Kings do speak about writing that, and also, you know, not just using the scandal to drive the story, like, you know, conscious there are real victims here as well, and just how you craft a drama, how you walk that line, I guess.
Yeah, this was sort of a delightful shortened season because of the pandemic, so 7 episodes. So the new season is rolling out weekly, Wednesdays 9:30 from September 23rd, and then once all episodes have aired, they'll all be available on SBS On Demand.
All right, well, yeah, look forward to seeing it.
Well, now I think it might be time for What Have You Been Watching?
Well, why don't I start by asking you, what have you been watching, Ben?
Well, I mean, as you know, as we've been discussing, I have been on a bit of a presidential content binge recently, and this started way back when I saw the musical Hamilton. So what I have recently been doing is a rewatch of the first season of The West Wing. Were you ever a West Wing viewer, Fee?
I was not. I'm not entirely on board with Aaron Sorkin's style.
Okay.
No, sorry.
Well, no, I welcome that feedback.
I know
feedback.
Of it.
It, as you say, the show was created by Aaron Sorkin, who is someone who, a writer which people either love or hate. I would say. He has certain trademarks and he likes wearing them sort of very heavily on his sleeve or in his scripts more accurately. But, you know, it's a fascinating show. It's a show which it won 9 Emmys in its first season, which I think is a record which still hasn't been broken. You know, it arrived at the tail end of the Clinton presidency, which, you know, we've just been talking about the legacy of that period. And, you know, it was a period which was wrought with partisan fractures. And then this show imagined a fresh Democratic president, Jed Bartlet, a very, you know, well-educated man who was a Nobel Prize winner for economics, not necessarily a hugely political beast. He'd never run for office before. And he's 1 year into his term as we start this first season, and he's surrounded by a team of idealistic White House staff. And then each episode is structured around some of the ethical, moral, and personal conflicts that might be encountered in office, whether it's okay to date a sex worker or a member of the press corps, how to manage the confidentiality of a history of alcohol and drug addiction, how to frame a military response to a terrorist attack in which one of your friends has died, and what compromises to make to gain support for a piece of legislation. And then after the election of George W. Bush in 2000, you know, which in itself was a controversial event, the show, I think, increasingly began to be seen as a bit of a sort of liberal fantasy of what a Democratic president might be like in comparison to the controversial figure that W. Bush turned out to be.
Yeah, I mean, though the past 4 years have kind of redefined controversial figures, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I guess sort of what hasn't gone away through the Clinton presidency, the Bush presidency, the Obama presidency, and Trump. That's his name.
No, I don't want to say his name either.
Yeah. is this kind of very divisive split between Republican and Democrat supporters and the left and the right. The show does try and walk a bit of a centrist line in terms of pleasing audiences, you know, on both sides of the aisle. But I think, you know, it was seen to sort of certainly have its sympathies, particularly when Aaron Sorkin was there for the first 4 seasons on that kind of liberal progressive ideal. But I think sort of rewatching it, I think there's a number of elements that feel very much of its time. And the first is just the overwhelming predominance of male characters, and the women sort of particularly early on are predominantly in kind of EA roles, whereas the men are all the chief of staff and communications director and et cetera, with the notable exception of Allison Janney as CJ Craig, who is a real strength of the series. And the only significant person of color is Dule Hill as the president's personal aide, who was added in episode 3, apparently in response to the NAACP objecting to the all-white cast. And he was saddled with the backstory of a mum who died due to inner city crime. She was a black police officer who died in the line of duty. So he's sort of defined by his race in that way.
Yeah.
And it did bug me that in an episode about the brewing conflict between India and Pakistan over the Kashmir region, the one expert that the president calls in for advice is a foppish British lord, which to me inadvertently reinforced these kind of ideas that it's the colonial powers that know what's best for these, you know, parts of the world. So elements of that haven't dated well, but the way the show is produced has been highly influential. And, you know, for a network drama, it has very complex ongoing plot elements which require quite detailed previously on recaps before the commencement of each episode. And the only network show that I can think of that had that prior to this was ER. There may have been others, but certainly it felt a lot more serialized than a lot of shows on network TV at that time.
Mm.
And just sort of the famously the walk and talk. those tracking shots through the White House corridors, which apparently incredibly bugged the daughter of President Gerald Ford, because she would sort of, knowing the White House layout intimately, she would be like saying, oh, they would have made a left turn there and they turned right. I can't believe it.
I mean, it's the little things like that. Yeah, no, details oriented.
But I probably sort of can only take so many speeches where the music swells and you know, you're being told that sort of someone's making a statement about America, land of the free. But
And here's where my iPad tap out. Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of a show that is very heavily invested in the minutiae of the political process, I think it's rewarding on that level.
And, of course, it's got Bradley Whitford and Elizabeth Moss in
it. It does.
They were reunited for Handmaids. So, yeah, that's my in.
You can just watch the Supercut just with their bits.
Yeah, then I'm done. All caught up.
So that's The West Wing, and every season is available on Stan. And Fee, what have you been watching? Please tell me it doesn't involve any presidents of the United States.
Well, it doesn't. Yeah. We've done a lot of American politics. So for anyone who didn't want to hear that and has stuck around just on the off chance we might change subjects, I'm here to help. No, I have been virtually in Toronto and currently still am. Well said, for the Toronto International Film Festival at the moment.
Helping yourself to some poutine.
Exactly, virtual poutine. because, yes, with, you know, pandemic, no travel, et cetera, events that were prohibitively expensive to attend before, are opening up because
we've all got free passes.
Get a virtual pass. I know. So I've been loving that. And I'll spare you kind of my shopping list of everything I've been watching. But one thing I loved, and we'll no doubt talk more about come Oscar season, because, you know, if there's any justice in the world, and I mean, it's debatable sometimes, but hopefully there will be, we're going to be talking a lot about One Night in Miami. And this film is the directorial debut, in movies anyway, of Regina King, Oscar winner Regina King, supporting actress.
In our episode about Watchmen.
Indeed, known for Watchmen, known for If Bill Street Could Talk, which is what she won the Oscar for. She's directed this film, which I absolutely adore, and it's adapted from a play by Kemp Powers, and he's adapted it for the screen. And basically, One Night in Miami, it's about an event that actually happened. It's the night of the 25th of February, 1964, when 22-year-old Cassius Clay defeated Sonny Liston to become heavyweight champion of the world. And then in Miami, he caught up with his good friends, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and footballer Jim Brown. And they, instead of going to an after party, they went back to Malcolm X's motel room, and he was a bit of a party pooper and wanted to have some real talk with them. it's so good because, like, the premise could, you know, in the wrong hands, this could be heavy and feel like the gravity of the subject might, you know, kill a bit of the interest in the story. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
But it's so good, and it manages to be powerful when it needs to be. When these four friends, you know, all successes in their fields, you know, they drop the public personas and they're just shit talking each other a bit, and complaining because Malcolm X, you know, is Muslim and doesn't have any alcohol in the motel room. And it's playful, but it's also, yeah, really powerful because, you know, they're challenging each other on what they're respectively doing for the movements. And it becomes really quite moving. And it's also the last time Cassius Clay was known by that name. Like, literally the next day, he announced his conversion to Islam and changed his name to Cassius X, and then ultimately Muhammad Ali. So the character's name is Cassius Clay in this.
Wow, a real moment in history.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a fictionalized account of the conversations in that room, but all of the performances are fantastic. And I've not seen a lot of the actors. They're known for TV shows I haven't really watched. So There's Kingsley Ben-Adir playing Malcolm X, and he's from things like High Fidelity and Peaky Blinders. There's Aldous Hodge, whose credits are things like City on a Hill, and he's playing Jim Brown. Then there's Leslie Odom Jr., who comes from Hamilton. He played Aaron Burr, and he, you know, being from Hamilton, we know he can sing, and he plays Sam Cooke. And there's a fantastic scene where he does an a cappella version of Working on the Chain Gang. That's just gorgeous. And then there's Eli Gorey, who's been in things like Ballers and Riverdale, and he's got the quite challenging task of playing Cassius Clay. And, I mean, we all know what Muhammad Ali was like with the bravado, and yeah, it's a tricky one to attempt because, you know, it could come off as just parody or impersonation, but no, he really captures, you know, seems to be the essence of Cassius / Muhammad. Yeah, and they all play off each other so well, and I don't know, Regina King might make history here with a director nomination, a director win. Hopefully she may become the you know, first Black director to win an Oscar. Hopefully.
That would be very exciting.
I know.
We haven't touched on this, but, of course, the new rules around Best Picture Oscar nominees kicking off in a few years' time have been announced. But yes, in order to try and encourage a bit more diverse wins in these different categories.
Yeah. And look, honestly, this is so well directed as well because, it, you know, it is based on a play, and films based on plays can feel a bit like film plays, but they've added some extra scenes with shot outside of the motel room. But, you know, within the motel, she just directs it so well, and that it's claustrophobic for the people in the motel having arguments, but you don't feel confined to it, and like she manages to find so much coverage within that small space to make it come alive. Yeah, I think it's so well directed and I loved it. Can you tell? And Amazon have picked that up. So I'm not sure if and when and how we'll get to see it, but I mean, we'll definitely get to see it and we'll be talking about it a bit more down the track. Come Oscar season, hopefully.
Great. That sounds so good. And
yeah, I loved it.
It makes me think of, you know, a show that we talked about a little while ago, earlier this year, Mrs. America, which what I really loved about that is it did take these quite intimate moments with real figures from history. And I'm particularly thinking of Uzo Aduba as Shirley Chisholm, who was the first Black woman to run for the nominee of a major political party as president.
Mm.
And just that episode where the convention is happening and all those little stories and how history happens in those little moments.
Yeah, absolutely. This is all it as well. The chemistry between them is what makes it, because you do get the sense these four are real friends. And it's because of that they can really prod each other's egos. And, you know, they've come from a boxing match and like it's still going a little bit. There's quite a bit of sparring going on. Yeah, and it's fascinating. And it's just reimagining a historical moment. Like it's, yeah, history was made that night. Yeah, one night in Miami.
Great. Look forward to it. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our show. So make sure you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts and give us a lot of stars, leave a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi. Don't at me about not watching West Wing.
And The Playlist is produced by Jeremy Wilmot. Until next time.
Thanks for listening.